a regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be talking with Representative Andrew Clyde from Georgia about the letter that he and nearly 50 of his colleagues in Congress, in both the House and the Senate, have sent to new Attorney General, no longer acting Attorney General, Todd Blanche, urging him and the DOJ to drop its appeal in the Jensen and silencer shot cases. These are the cases combined where we had a U.S. District Judge in Texas last week conclude that the National Firearms Act's registration requirements for things like suppressors, short-barreled firearms, any other weapons, is now invalid because the making and the transfer taxes on those NFA items have been zeroed out under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And as Representative Clyde had argued, when this bill was actually in the process of becoming law, the registry is a registry of who has paid this tax. And if there is no tax to be paid, how can you have a registry? In fact, the intent of Congress was to remove the registry as well, but the Senate parliamentarian said, no, that's not germane to the budget bill, right? It's not a budgetary item. The tax itself was. And even though, again, the registry was a registry of who paid the tax, parliamentarian said that had to stay, but the taxes could disappear. So Judge Hendricks' decision comports with both congressional intent and the plain letter of the Constitution. As the judge said, you can't cite Congress's taxing power to uphold this registration requirement when Congress is no longer levying a tax. The DOJ's position is, well, actually, there is a tax. There's a special operator's tax that's still imposed. And if you don't like that theory, then Congress still has the authority under the Commerce Clause to regulate items that are in interstate commerce. And that would include, if Congress wants, a registration requirement for these items. Judge Hendricks didn't buy it. I don't know that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals will be any more amenable to that argument, but I don't know that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is going to actually hear this case, because, again, that's the decision that the DOJ has to make. And that deadline is today, apparently. The Judge Hendricks said that he would stay his decision for a week in order to give the DOJ time to appeal. Well, that was a week ago. And so we should learn later today, might be tomorrow morning, but hopefully later today, what the DOJ is going to do. So again, had the opportunity to sit down with Representative Andrew Clyde, talk about that letter that he sent, talk about why he believes it's important for the DOJ not to appeal this case, what he would like to see the DOJ do instead, but also what he and fellow Republicans in Congress are trying to do on their end going forward to remove the NFA registration requirements and, again, help to strengthen our Second Amendment rights. Take a look and a listen. Congressman, thanks so much for your time. It's good to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you. Great to be with you, Cam.
And, I guess we don't have too long to wait before we learn what the DOJ is going to do here with the silencer shop Jensen cases, a huge decision coming out of the U.S. District Court in Texas. And one that, I've written about this at Bearing Arms, is right in line with what you and other members of Congress have been saying since the debate over the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, right? That if you zero out the taxes on these NFA items, well, the registry, by its very nature, is a registry of who's paid that tax. So how can this registry exist? And a federal judge has essentially said, yeah, you guys are right, that Congress's taxing power cannot be used to justify a registry when there is no tax being imposed on these items, right?
That is exactly correct, Cam. And as a matter of fact, What the judge came out and said literally followed our talking points point by point by point and validated absolutely everything that we said that we did in the One Big Beautiful Bill that the Department of Justice under Pam Bondi refused to acknowledge. And that was very concerning. You know, before they came out with their quote decision back November of last year, we wrote them a letter and suggested, you know, kind of laid out the intent of Congress. And then when they came out with their opinion, it was not that, not what we said. And so we wrote them another letter in December expressing our displeasure with that and telling them they need to reverse course and come in line with what the intent of Congress was. And now here you have the federal court coming out and validating exactly what we said was the intent of Congress. And that is if you eliminate the taxation, because the whole reason the NFA was allowed was because it was under the Article I enumerated power of lay and collect taxes, which, you know, is in the Constitution that Congress has. Once you eliminate that and make the tax zero, then the registration scheme to collect the taxes based on the serial numbers of the firearms that are taxed, all right, then that foundation crumbles and it goes to nothing. And that's exactly what we said. But ATF under Pam Bondi said, oh, no, there's now a $0 tax. Well, a $0 tax is no tax at all. And that's what the court said. And I'm very, very pleased with the decision. I read the all 66 pages of it. It's an amazing document that is truly in line with the constitutional foundation of our government.
Absolutely. And you have penned a letter joined by about 50 of your colleagues in Congress to Attorney General Todd Blanche, urging him to accept the judge's mm-hmm. decision, right, to not appeal this decision, and in fact to codify what the judge has said through rules and regulations going forward, right?
That's exactly correct. It's actually 47 signatures, and that number was significant. We did that on purpose, all right? Eight senators and 39 members of the House. So it's a bicameral letter that explains what we think that the new attorney general in the Department of Justice should be doing. And that is, number one, not appeal the decision, because the decision is the right decision. It's the correct decision. It's the constitutional decision. That's number one. And then number two, apply it nationwide. You know, though the district court cannot do a nationwide injunction anymore, I think the judge wrote it in such a way that it was the most favorable to that in applying to everyone, because you have these organizations like Gun Owners of America, all right, where it applies to members, all members of Gun Owners of America, present and future. So literally is all you have to do is become a member of Gun Owners of America and you're covered by this decision. All right. But
and also the customers are included in that as well, right? But
that's correct.
But again, not every company that sells NFA items is a plaintiff in this case, right? So you could argue that now companies like Silencer Shop may have an unfair advantage because their customers are included in this injunction. But if you buy a suppressor from, you know, somewhere else that's not an organizational plaintiff, well, then you might not be covered unless, again, you're a member of GOA or one of the other organizational plaintiffs. So I think you're right. The judge did, and he explicitly said, we don't have the power to do universal injunctions, but he did write this broad enough, I think as broadly as he possibly could.
I think he did, and I thank him for it tremendously because it's a beautiful decision. And, you know, you can't have it apply, as I wrote in the letter, you know, you can't have it apply to one neighbor and not the other neighbor. You know, you cannot unequally apply the law. So that was the reason that I said, hey, this needs to be applied. Because honestly, if you look at it, the court case didn't need to happen at all. All right. If the Department of Justice would have simply recognized what Congress did when we wrote the legislation and the president signed it. And the need for the court case wasn't there if the Department of Justice would have done the right thing in the first place. But now we have additional validation that Congress did the right thing, eliminated the foundation, therefore eliminated the registration scheme of all of that. So I think that's a very important point right there. So this Department of Justice needs to follow that, apply it nationwide. That was point number two in our letter. And then point number three, okay, was they need to through the rulemaking process, ensure that this decision is followed for future administrations. And they can do that through creating a rule that says, hey, this is the way this has to be applied. And once they create a rule, then it takes a whole lot more to overturn that rule. It would literally take a Congressional Review Act to overturn that rule, which is, there's a question as to whether you give the executive too much authority when it comes to a rule versus what Congress does. But in this case, a rule from the Department of Justice implementing this policy, I think, is absolutely critical. And that's why that was the point three in the letter.
I've heard the counter argument to this from gun owners, from Second Amendment advocates who appreciate the judge's decision here, is, well, if the DOJ appeals this, if they don't ask for a stay, but if they continue the appeal, we'll most likely get affirmation from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. They're most likely to concur with the judge's opinion. And potentially even the Supreme Court would accept this case. And if they don't accept this case, they deny cert. Well, the Fifth Circuit's judgment would still stand, at least within the Fifth Circuit. Are there any pitfalls or dangers, you think, beyond the DOJ defending a law that you think is, invalid? Are there any pitfalls for gun owners that could come into play, in your opinion, if the DOJ does continue to defend the registry?
Well, I think there's huge pitfalls here. Number one, you now have the risk of another court decision, okay, which I think would literally go in line with what the district court said. The appellate court would then agree with the district court. Whether it would go to the Supreme Court or not, there's like a 1% chance or less than that for any case to make it to the Supreme Court. All right. But here we have the Department of Justice clearly, if they appeal it, clearly trying to enforce an unconstitutional law that the court has said and Congress has said is unconstitutional. So two branches of government against the third branch of government is saying you're doing the wrong thing. All right. So I think that's really important. But there are also election implications here that are very, very broad. Think of it like this. Right now, within the gun owning community, the atmosphere is electric. They're like, wow, this is literally the potential of the biggest win in the history of our country when it comes to restoring Second Amendment rights. I truly believe that. And then so going into the election of this November, and we're just like 90 days away, less than 90 days away, you would have an energized Second Amendment community that would be going out to vote and saying, thank you, Mr. President, for restoring our constitutional rights. All right. But if they appeal it, then I think we risk the opposite effect. We greatly risk the many of the gun owner community going, hey, this administration doesn't support us. They don't support the Second Amendment. They said they did, but they don't. All right. And so therefore, we're just going to stay home. And I think that's a very real possibility. I don't want that. I think everybody needs to go out and vote. All right. It's your civic responsibility, in my opinion, especially when you're a conservative. But that's just not the way with a lot of folks. And so I think that this huge win for the Second Amendment community could literally help us go over the top in many races. And ensure that we keep the House, the majority in the House, keep the majority in the Senate, and allow us then to do even more things in this next in the next congressional term. So there's a big risk here, and I think the administration actually understands that.
Have you any inkling what the DOJ might do? Have you had any response to the letter?
I have had no response as of yet. I have made inroads into the White House and explaining the position here. And there's been some senators, as you see, that are on this letter as well. 8 senators, 39 members of the House. It's very, very important, the decision that is made by the Department of Justice here. And I'm cautiously hopeful that our new Attorney General, Todd Blanche, will make the right decision to not appeal this and then follow along with the recommendations of my letter.
You know, and I know that typically the DOJ defends existing laws, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of their purview. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you talk about Pam Bondi back when she was Attorney General of Florida. She did the same thing. She defended the Florida law that bans adults under the age of 21 from purchasing firearms. Florida's new Attorney General, James Uthmeyer, has taken a very different approach. And when there are laws that he believes are unconstitutional, he has said, I'm not going to defend this law. He has, you know, worked with plaintiffs in cases to, you know, come to an agreement regarding open carry of firearms, regarding, you know, gun sales to young adults. So it is possible for the Attorney General to say, yes, while I have a duty to defend the law, if I believe that this law is indefensible, I also have a duty to the Constitution, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. In fact, if you look at it, if you want to look at it that way, you can say, well, wait a minute. I have a duty to defend current law. Well, what is current law? The one big, beautiful bill is current law. All right. So he has a duty to defend what Congress did in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and that is eliminating the taxation of a constitutional right, eliminating the taxation in the National Firearms Act, and therefore eviscerating it, removing its foundation. He has, you know, the duty to defend that. Okay. And Pam Bondi did not.
You know, when we were talking as the One Big Beautiful Bill was being debated and going through the parliamentarians' review, you had said, I mean, again, clearly this was Congress's intent. You tried to have the registry language in there, but the parliamentarians stripped it out, saying that it was not budget related. You know, there's a lot of talk again about maybe a third reconciliation bill, you know, other funding mechanisms where, you know, obviously, there are a number of issues that that could be put in that legislation. Is there anything, Congressman, that you would like to include in a future reconciliation bill if Congress goes that route that you think would solidify the Second Amendment, would benefit gun owners, would get rid of unconstitutional language that is currently in statute?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great question, Cam. In fact, one of the arguments that the Department of Justice had, which was absolutely shredded by the court, was the argument that, oh, well, there's still a special occupational tax stamp that the dealers have to pay, okay, if you're going to deal in NFA firearms. Well, and what the court said is there was actually a tax collection scheme for the special occupational tax stamp. And that scheme is separate from the tax collection scheme from the NFA firearms themselves. So therefore, what the court said is, well, the SOT tax collection scheme is still in place. It is separate in a separate section. All right. And so therefore, they are separate. They are completely separate. The one stays in place for the SOT, but the other one for the actual firearms themselves, the making and transfer tax both, is eliminated because the tax is eliminated. However, for One Big Beautiful Bill number 3, I have a big bullseye on the special occupational tax stamp for zero tax firearms. Oh, yes, I will be going after that, and I think I've got support for that as well. So that will definitely be part of it. It will remove one of the DOJ's arguments that they won't be able to have anymore, is that the SOT covers that, but it doesn't. There's no way that it does. I mean, I can give you example after example. You make your own firearm. It has nothing to do with an SOT, right? If it's, you make your own NFA firearm, doesn't go through an SOT. So how does the SOT apply to that? It doesn't. So, I mean, their argument is like Swiss cheese. It's all full of holes.
Well, Congressman, listen, I appreciate your continued efforts here in this regard. And again, I share your enthusiasm about Judge Hendricks' decision. And, you know, I've thought long and hard about it. My initial reaction when I saw the news was, yeah, I hope the DOJ does not appeal, that they take the loss here. I've considered the arguments from the other side, and, you know, I ultimately still come down the same position that you come down on. I think that the odds of the Supreme Court granting cert are slim. By the time that happens, God forbid, we could see a different makeup of the Supreme Court. You know, I think that it's better to take this win, as you say, to take steps to apply this nationwide via DOJ policy, and to establish again that rule that would keep this in place and would be difficult for future administrations to undo. I think that is the most pragmatic way of ensuring that this victory stands.
And also what I think we can do now as well is we can take this court decision and we can say all of these sections within the law that the court declared were unconstitutional, all right, is draft another piece of legislation to say, okay, these now need to go away. They've been declared unconstitutional by the court. You know, if the DOJ needs additional assistance, which is why I put that at the bottom of the letter, all right, happy to work with you on this, all right, that we can introduce legislation backed up by the Supreme or by the district court decision that these are unconstitutional and eliminate those as well. Now, getting that through a Democrat Senate might be a different, you know, a filibuster in a Democrat Senate might be an issue, but we can certainly do that, and we're happy to do that. But right. I'll tell you something real quick. This decision, and number one, the decision didn't need to happen. What Congress did was enough in the One Big Beautiful Bill. All right, but there are a lot. Even though I wrote the legislation myself, okay, came up with the idea of doing it through budget reconciliation, which had never been done before, but it took a lot more than just me to make this happen. All right, when it comes to one member of Congress, all right, you've got the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Jason Smith, all right, who, when I presented the idea to him, was like, wow, yeah, I think we can do this, all right? And then you have the Budget Committee folks that stood, you know, strong and delayed the One Big Beautiful Bill for a couple of days until we could get both the making and the transfer tax in there. The transfer tax was in it, but the making tax wasn't. If you don't take out both taxes, the foundation, the scheme, the taxing scheme foundation still exists. So we had to eliminate both taxes. We did that in the budget committee, getting a manager's amendment in the rules committee before it went to the floor for a final vote in the House. So there are a lot of folks that use their influence and put their vote on the line to make sure this happened. So I gotta give a shout out to them too.
Absolutely. And I mean, and the results are plain to see. You know, the NSSF puts out its numbers every month, and the numbers of, you know, checks on NFA items continues to be more than double what it was this time last year when the One Big Beautiful Bill Act was not in effect. So, you know, clearly there was this demand, and, you know, Americans are now more easily able to exercise their rights to purchase things like suppressors without having to pay this $200 tax, and hopefully soon without having to register these items as well. Representative Andrew Clyde, I will be watching just as you will to see what the DOJ does. I'd love to have you back again in the future. Hopefully we can celebrate the DOJ's decision, but if not, then we can talk about next steps then.
That sounds great. Great to be with you, Cam, as always.
All right, Congressman, thanks so much for your time. Great talking to you today.
Take care.
My thanks again to Representative Clyde. Always enjoy the conversations that we get to have and look forward to doing this again in the near future. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, which comes to us from the Indiana State Fair. Roasted corn stand worker with lengthy criminal history accused in Indiana State Fair stabbing. Yeah, you know, we were talking, I think earlier this week, about the Texas State Fair. I know I was talking about it on Newsmax with Carl Higbee last night. The carry ban at the Texas State Fair, and whether or not Attorney General Ken Paxton is going to appeal a recent decision that upheld the gun-free Texas State Fair. This, to me, is an argument in favor of the right to carry. We know that violent crime can happen anywhere. It doesn't always involve a gun. And even in quote-unquote gun-free zones, sometimes criminals disobey those signs. In this case, it was apparently a box cutter that was the weapon of choice for the suspect in question here. And the victim, according to police, the man's nephew, 37-year-old Stephen Mims, arrested over the weekend on preliminary charges of attempted murder, escaping home detention, and resisting law enforcement, now being held in the Marion County Jail as he awaits official charges He was taken into custody early Sunday morning after police found him hiding in the attic of a home on the east side of Indianapolis. According to the police report that was filed in connection with his arrest, Indiana State police troopers who were on routine patrol at the fairgrounds were called about 10:20 Saturday night to the Wilson's Concessions roasted sweet corn stand for a report of a stabbing. When they got there, they found a man suffering from a 6 to 9 inch gash on his shoulder. The victim later taken to a local hospital for serious injuries that required further treatment. And while he was there at the hospital, he talked with police about what had happened. The victim's a manager there at the corn stand, said that he started the day having some issues with his uncle, who also worked at the stand. His uncle, identified as Mims, had been giving away free corn to customers, and that he confronted Uncle Stevie about it. The manager said that Mims began making threats to kill him and his family, kept asking to meet the manager in the parking lot, said that the beef lasted throughout the day, with the two exchanging words behind the stand as they worked. And then towards the end of the day, the victim said that Mims continued to give out free food while making verbal threats. Then when he turned away from Mims, the victim said he was struck in the face and felt a cut on his right shoulder. Witnesses say they saw Mims grab a box cutter that was used to shuck corn and then stab the victim with it. And they said that Mims then ran away from the scene. Now, as it turns out, Mims is currently on home detention for a pending domestic battery case in Marion County. So he shouldn't have even been working the roasted corn stand at the state fair. But since he's on home detention, he had an electronic monitor device placed on him. In fact, Mims had recently asked to have that tracker removed. The judge denied that request. So police were able to use that GPS monitoring device, which Mims did not cut off, using the box cutter that he allegedly used to stab his nephew. And they found him in a home, again, on the east side of Indianapolis. The Indiana State Police then applied for and was granted a search warrant for the home. SWAT team was able to track him down in the attic of the home. And then when they searched a car that was parked at the home, investigators reportedly found the red and black box cutter that they say was used in the stabbing. So, again, not the sharpest box cutter in the drawer, apparently. You've got access to a very sharp object. You don't use it to cut off your ankle monitor. But anyway, whatever. Mims was then taken to a local hospital for evaluation. After he was medically cleared, he was taken to the U.S. State Police Headquarters for an interview. But he reportedly, quote, provided no meaningful conversation and became argumentative, began coughing and actually spitting inches away from troopers' faces. Court documents say that, quote, Mims made a comment indicating that he did not care about a level 6 battery on an officer charge when he was being charged with attempted murder. And, you know, we've talked about this before, right? In fact, I mean, this is one of the arguments, again, against gun-free zones. Somebody who is intent on committing murder doesn't care that they're violating a misdemeanor law that says you can't bring guns in this place, right? They don't care about that. That law is not going to stop somebody who is planning more serious crimes. In this case, Mims, facing more serious crimes, said, I'm not really, what are you going to do to me? I already charged me with attempted murder. Anyway, Mims was booked into jail on preliminary charges of attempted murder, escaping home detention, and resisting law enforcement. Court records show that Mims has a lengthy criminal history in Indiana dating back to at least 2006. Again, currently facing charges of domestic battery with a prior conviction, intimidation, and battery. But in Marion County, there are at least 17 other cases that have been filed against Mims, including a battery to a public safety official in July of 2021, battery with a deadly weapon and intimidation in 2020, unlawful firearm possession, battery and criminal recklessness in 2019, two counts of felony domestic battery also in 2019, unlawful firearm possession, possession of marijuana in 2017. And again, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. So why has Mr. Mims, who has faced so many serious charges, not faced serious time behind bars? I think is an open question, one that we don't have the answer to. But there is another opportunity for the criminal justice system to deliver justice here. Whether that happens, very much an open question. On to today's armed citizen story from Florida, where a man was killed in a shooting during a confrontation at a home in Leesburg, where the homeowner fired a gun at the intruder who's allegedly attempting to force his way inside. This happened a couple of days ago. I haven't seen any updates to this story. This was Saturday night. Again, at a home in Leesburg, Florida, Lake County, Florida. Deputies responded shortly before 9:30 in the evening to a reported shooting. Investigators say that the guy who was shot showed up unannounced at the home. The guy's ex-girlfriend is inside the home visiting another gentleman. The ex-boyfriend then becomes involved in a physical confrontation with the homeowner and allegedly attempted to force his way inside the home, which is when the homeowner fired a gun, striking the man who was pronounced dead at the scene. Lake County Sheriff's, again, came out to investigate. They did not make an arrest at the scene. At last report, the officials have not released the identities of those involved. But if this was, if this happened the way that the police have reported it, then this is going to be a justified use of force. You've got somebody just showing up at somebody's home and banging on the door does not present a threat to your life and limb, right? You can't say, well, this guy showed up and he started pounding and I could tell that he was angry. And so I was in fear for my life. So I shot him. That's not going to fly, especially again, if you're behind a locked door. When, however, you physically attack somebody in their home, or you physically attack them, let's say they open the door, you start to go after them, you're fighting them, and you're trying to get inside that home, at that point, the calculus has changed, right? At that point, okay, we know that this person has violent intent. You are where you have a legal right to be. And when you're being assaulted, at that point, I think you do have a reasonable belief of great bodily injury, right? It is reasonable to believe that this guy wants to hurt you, perhaps wants to hurt his ex-girlfriend, because he is actively trying to hurt you. So, again, I suspect that this is going to be ruled a justifiable use of force, but we need to wait for the official determination from the Lake County Sheriff's Office and the Lake County State's Attorney. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Some good Samaritans in Port St. Lucie, Florida, who helped save an autistic child from a retention pond. This is, I think, the second story we've had this year, maybe like in the last two or three months, where a child with autism has, basically escaped from their home and ended up in a retention pond. Melinda Dreyer and her sister were driving down the street when they saw this kid cross the road. Dreyer said, when he walked in front of the car, he gave us a blank stare, and something in my gut just didn't feel right. She said, I knew if he was possibly autistic that the water wasn't going to be in a good situation. The five-year-old had, in fact, wandered away from his home, started going into the pond. Melinda Dreyer and her sister, Melinda threw the car in park, or she and her sister got out of the car. Other residents saw what was going on. They ran over to help. Dreyer said the boy started taking off his clothes in the water. She said everything happened so fast, it was scary. She said after about 10 minutes, the group managed to guide the boy out of the water to safety. Police arrived shortly thereafter. They said the boy was covered in fire ants, but was otherwise physically unharmed. Again, thankfully, Melinda Dreyer and her sister saw that something was out of the ordinary, were concerned enough to watch to see what was going on. And when they realized, okay, yeah, we need to intervene, they did. And there were other neighbors in the area who also saw what was happening, stepped forward to assist. You couldn't ask for a better response than that. And it looks like this little boy is going to be okay. Hopefully, mom and dad can put some extra security measures in place around the house so he can't get out quite as easily as he did before. But we're glad that Melinda Dreyer, her sister, and the other Good Samaritans there in Port St. Lucie, Florida, were in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Buried Arms, Cam & Company, and I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We'll be talking about the DOJ's decision. Hopefully, we'll have that in hand. And, you know, we're still waiting on a number of other court decisions around the country. Every morning, I wake up. Is this the day we're going to get the Kuhn-Siegel case out of the Third Circuit, the case dealing with New Jersey's gun-free zones? So far, every day, the answer has been no. But that case is still out there. I wrote a piece this morning for Bearing Arms about the Second Amendment Foundation filing a cert petition with the Supreme Court in another New Jersey-related case. This is Defense Distributed versus Davenport, a case challenging the New Jersey law that criminalizes the dissemination of computer code that can be used to print 3D, you know, 3D print gun parts. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals has said that that code is not speech because it is not expressive, and therefore New Jersey can ban the dissemination of those computer files. The Sixth Circuit has held differently in a different case. So there is a circuit court split. There's also an interesting venue split because the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, where this lawsuit was originally filed, says that it actually has jurisdiction over this case. The Third Circuit disagrees. Says no. This was filed against the New Jersey Attorney General. It's you know, it should be held or heard in New Jersey. So you not only have a question about whether or not these files again have any First Amendment protections, but also where this case should be adjudicated to begin with. Kind of fascinating. Anyway, so well, we've got that case outstanding. We've got a number of other cert petitions that are on course to be scheduled or on course to be filed here in the next few weeks. And then again, dozens of Second Amendment cases percolating in the lower courts. So we're keeping a close eye on all of those, as well as what's going on with the DOJ. So we check it out at bearingarms.com. We'll see you back here again tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.